Peace and love. This is Sarok, and you are listening to Mastermind.
You are now part of the social experiment.
See, now where my limit is. Only God knows. It's like they just want to see you struggle. I swear they don't want to see you shine.
They don't.
It's like they just want you to bleed and they want you to fall. They don't want you to be where the streets are paved with gold.
Welcome to Mastermind, the home of Black excellence and self-mastery. Yes, your host, Mr. G.
Welcome to the program. Thank you for joining us today on the journey towards self-mastery. Our next guest is one of the dopest MCs in the game. She hails from DC and discovered her rhyming abilities and artistry through her collaboration with the talented producer Soul Messiah. She has performed on stages all over the world. She has collaborated with the likes of David Banner, Styles P, Chronix, J Electronica, Brother Ali, Loaded Lux, Rhapsody, Black Thought, and many more. She has produced over 13 albums and mixtapes and has performed on the prestigious NPR Tiny Desk Concert Series. You can check out her latest album, Sharecropper's Daughter, through all streaming platforms. Let's welcome today the goddess MC, Sarok, to the program. Sarok, how you doing today?
I'm good. How are you? Good to be here.
I'm really, really good. We were just talking before we went live, and you were definitely on my wish list of people to get on the Mastermind program when everything was created in my head. So I feel like really blessed right now to be talking with you. So it is an honor.
Just good to know. That means I'm doing something right. Honor is mine.
Absolutely. I remember listening to Sky God back in the day, like just on repeat. I'm like, yo, where did she get all of this? Like, you know what I mean? That was before I knew you had like a biology background. I'm like, oh, okay. Like I kind of understand it now, but that was,
Yeah.
That was a dope track. I used to just listen to the whole thing over and over and try to break down like everything you were saying. So yeah, man, I appreciate the great work that you have done over the years and the consistency. And I think we need music like that. You know what I mean? Especially in a time frame where it's tempting as a female artist to kind of go the other route and produce content that you know people will vibe to and rock to, especially if you're a good looking female and you know that you can sell through other means. So I appreciate you staying consistent and yourself and being modest.
Yeah, it really wasn't a choice for me, you know, and as I embarked on music and just really anything I do, I try to stay authentic to who I am as a person. So like, you know, there's never the option of I'll put on someone else's persona or character in order to garner more success or money or whatever. My music and artistry is really just another facet of me. So it's always going to be Asada, you know, that's my given name. It's always going to be Asada at the heart of Sarok.
Absolutely. You know, we thank you for that. In the midst of all the chaos in the music industry, we need people like you that kind of clear all that through. So thank you for that. Instead of your name, Asada, you went with the name Sarok. So before we get started, can you kind of explain why you went with that name and what Sarok means?
I just wanted to have a stage name outside of my given name because, you know, as an artist, you want to maintain a certain level of privacy and things that are just yours. So I wanted my name to be that. I don't keep it a secret that that's my name, but you know, my stage name is something different. And it just kind of makes it clear the boundaries and accessibility that, you know, supporters and people have of me. When I'm Sarok, and Asada is at home with fam and doing whatever. But Sa is taken from directly from Sarok. When I was younger, people used to call me Sasa or Sa. So like that's an homage to my original name. And I wanted something to denote just the strength and power and just kind of ferocity with which I spit, like that hardness. So I was like, okay, rock, that'd be dope. And then my name kind of unfolded. So I had this initial reason for naming myself Sarok. And then as I learned more, I would incorporate those meanings of layers of meanings into my name. So then I was reading this book on Egyptology. And I read that the sound or the hieroglyph or Medunas hair, whatever, however you want to call it, for the word protection in ancient Kemetic language is Sa. So I was like, oh man, that's perfect because I consider myself a protector of the culture, a protector of the people, you know, so then add in another layer into what my name means so that the style was added into it. And then rock, I was like, okay, so I initially was like rock for, you know, the hardness and you know, the power, but what if it was a semi-precious stone? What if it was something that could conduct, you know, energy? What if it's something that could transmutate into, you know, anything greater, something more valuable, more worth? So I was like, okay, so the rock is going to be representing a gem, you know, Lauryn Hill, don't be a hard rock when you really are a gem. So I was like, okay, boom, another layer of meaning. Then the final piece, when I met producer DJ Soul Messiah, I always tell the story about how, you know, I didn't grow up like wanting to be an MC or writing. I wrote poetry and I wrote just stories, short stories and things like that. So I was always a writer, but I wasn't an MC. So I met him. So there were some kind of foundational things that he had to teach me about hip hop and the culture and stuff, you know, just outside of just being a listener, growing up listening to hip hop. Right. So like he would expose me to classic hip hop movies. So Beach Street was one of the movies that he sat down and watched with me. And it turned out to be like one of my favorite movies. I love that movie so much. But there's a female MC in that film, at a party scene in that film. Her name is Shyrock. And so he broke it down for me. Like, she's one of the first women pioneers, first woman MCs, early rappers in the game. She was in a group called Funky Four Plus One. And she was... maybe she was the plus one. I'm not sure. Let me not say, but Funky Four Plus One More. And she was popping, you know, she was holding her own in a group with all men. And they were on Saturday Night Live in like, I believe it was 79 that they were on Saturday Night Live. And so that, when I found that out, I wanted to add that as another layer to the name, as an homage to her, for her and women like her who laid the ground, the path for me to walk upon, who made it that much easier for me to like use my voice and carve out my space in this genre.
Yeah, that makes sense. And that is so deep. And it's just so interesting too, like some of the things you didn't even intend with the name Shyrock, it just came about. And it speaks to, I think, the, you know, the identification of a name and how we embody it. So it's really interesting. But you were talking to a little bit about, you know, coming up and everything. And I wanted to get into that a little bit. I was looking at a little bit of your story and I read that for the first 18 months, you didn't speak at all. Like what was that about? Did you get any stories from your parents and family about, you know, the experience with that and how you started speaking and all that?
The stories they love to tell is that, so I was born premature and that's the reason why, like my lungs were not fully developed. And I think that all of this stuff, all of like our life's paths, not to say that we don't have free will, because I think it's a combination of free will and destiny. There are some things that we were brought to this planet to imbue and like serve, fulfill, you know, in our life's path. And all of these things, as I look back on my life and the challenges that I've had, they were setting me up to do and be who I am. So anyway, I was born prematurely. 3 months premature. And because of that, my windpipes and my lungs were not developed enough for me to breathe on my own. So I was in the hospital for primarily the first year of my life. And I had a trach tube in my throat, which meant I couldn't speak. I couldn't make a sound. So my parents would always say when I got home that I would just be furious that I couldn't be heard. So I would be crying, but it was like a whisper. It was like that. And my face would be like beet red, you know, I'm a little light skinned baby. Like my face would be beet red. I'm screaming. I'm angry that I can't like express myself and I can't be heard the way I would have liked to have been. And it's funny that because of that, there's this understanding that our physical selves have, you know, these layers of attachment to our spiritual selves. So like a lot of things like our chakras, for example, are directly tied to the physical manifestations of like their location in the body. So like the throat chakra, which is the chakra for communication, for example, is usually when you're tapped in, you know, writers use, you know, utilize that. And as a consequence of my upbringing, my childhood, because I couldn't, you know, I had these issues with my throat and speaking, I always had like issues with my throat, like sore throats, and I had bronchitis, like things with my lungs and my throat. And I was a very shy, reserved child. And I think that that continued like throughout the course of my life. It shifted from shyness to just being just a little bit more reserved. And I never thought that I would be in front of anyone. I never thought that I would be doing anything. Of course, I had dreams. I used to want to be an actress and stuff like that. I had dreams of what I wanted to do. But I never thought that I would be an orator or like any kind of like thing where I had to be exposed at, you know, the most extreme levels, you know. But anyway, these issues, these challenges with the throat just kept like persisting. And then eventually I kind of like stumbled upon writing and being an MC, like I said, meeting Soul Messiah and figuring out that this was, you know, my superpower, if you will. And it's funny when you become in sync with your life path designation, how things just start to unfold for you and things begin to open up when you just flow with it instead of resisting what you think is not for you. And that's what I did. And I continued to just kind of challenge that part of me. And I continued to challenge that part of me that, you know, that craves my privacy and craves my anonymity and, you know, all these things. But I think when I think about what a larger purpose I'm serving, not only for my own self, you know, self-preservation, self-healing, and all these things that writing and performing does for me, but what my grander mission is to encourage people to empower themselves and elevate and understand how deeply rooted we are in this incredible, incredibly brilliant, and rich history, culture, birthright. So it's, that's important to me. So I fight through those other challenges that I have to continue to do the work.
Oh, no. You gotta break that down. Cause I think that that is special too. Like not you're being premature and not using your voice for 18 months. And now it's like your voice is your main mode of communication. And that's what you use all the time. Like that just, I think just speaks volumes in regards to like symbolism and just everything. So thank you for sharing that with us. Another part of your journey, your childhood, which was, it's kind of like maneuvering through different components, I think, of Black culture and who we are. So you grew up in DC in the height of the crack era and everything. And at the same time, you also had conscious parents and you were seeing the best of Black folks as well through your education in also African-centered school. So what exactly, how did you process that growing up as a kid? You know, you're seeing the best and the worst of Black folks at the same time. Like what was going through your head in your journey and what was that experience like?
It was interesting. It was an interesting thing because I mean, I valued growing up in Southeast DC. I valued growing up in what we call the hood because it made me feel like I was streetwise. You know, I knew what was going on. My father was a cab driver and he made sure to just kind of teach us how to keep an eye out for certain like signs and indicators of what was going on the street. Like he would be, you know, pointing out like, you know, look at his hands, that, you know, that's a sign of someone who's like uses heroin. See, he's nodding off. Like he would point out all these different things. So we would know and not be caught unawares in any situation that could be like dangerous to us or, you know, or just like have an understanding of our environment. So I cherished that in that I knew how to navigate the streets. I was not sheltered in the sense that I was kept from seeing, like you, as you would say, the worst of, you know, some of these environments. But then when I would go to my school, like a lot of my, you know, students and stuff, they actually were, they were sheltered. I mean, it's hard to be completely sheltered in DC because DC is like, it is literally divided amongst like social status. You know what I mean? So not, there weren't too many rich kids going to my, there weren't any rich kids going to my school. Everybody was just trying to get by. There were some that were doing better than we were, of course, but so it was a blessing. So in the midst of that, I would leave the streets, go into my home, and then, you know, we'd have all kinds of dope books on Pan-Africanism and like Black history, culture, sculptures on the wall. And my father's was a painter as well. Like that was his passion. And so he would have his art on the wall. And, you know, so, and then I would go from there to school where we were learning African languages and we were learning African dance and the brothers were learning drumming. And like, there was this, it was like a safe haven for me. But then like also the worlds kind of collided, you know, it was just a lesson on nothing is ever that clean. So like I had elements of that era and that time pervading my home as well. So like it was an interesting time navigating that growing up and being frustrated with my inability to escape certain negative aspects of that environment. And DC is an interesting place in any way, because it's like this cultural mashup of, you know, you have all these people from all over the world. There's this strong African-centered community. There is, you know, strong Muslim communities in DC. There, and then there's all like the museums and, you know, all the culture, it just is there. Sometimes like if you grow up in areas like mine, you feel removed from that. You feel alienated from that. But despite like everything that we had going on, my parents made sure to like push that culture on me. So I knew that it was more than that. That's why I always like spit about like, yeah, there may be some trauma in our experiences and history and all that, but there's so much triumph. There's so much joy. There's so much beauty. There's so much, so many lessons and value. So I was getting all of that. I was getting all the trauma and I was getting all the beauty. So it was interesting, but it made me who I am. DC is like such a diverse place. So I'm listening to go-go, which is like, you know, the local music of DC that has like African percussion and funk and hip hop, all that influence. And then I'm also listening to like all my little alternative rock stuff and my hip hop. And so it's just like a cultural mashup, which I'm grateful for.
Got it. Another part of your school too, like your school journey, like you were introduced to a lot of like Black artists and activists that were like generational, like, you know, Stokely Carmichael, AKA Kwame Ture. Like, what was it like meeting and being introduced to him? Like what type of person was he in person? Do you remember? I know you were a kid and everything.
Well, I didn't get to like have any one-on-one like these, because I had this teacher that her name is Hasanatu Kamara. She's passed on, but like, she's the reason why I do what I do. And she was the daughter of a Garveyite, brilliant mind, firecracker. She will curse you out in a second, but she was like this incredible creative. She was my creative writing teacher. And she was able to point out early on like what my potential was. And she was always trying to encourage me to break out of my shell and express like what I could express creatively. Anyway, Kwame Ture was like her brother. Like that was her best friend. Because she was an actress and a writer, she was linked into all these like incredible heavyweights. And she was the reason why a lot of those people came to our school, and they would do like little mini lectures for us. So Kwame Ture, Haile Gerima, who was a director and writer of the movie Sankofa film. If y'all haven't seen it, check it out on Netflix. I think it's still on there, but it was one of the realest, I think, portrayals of the actual slave trade. And she was featured in that as well. I say all that to say I didn't get a chance to do a one-on-one with him, but, you know, just being able to sit at his feet and like hear this man who I had studied speak. And I was pretty young, but I still understood the impact, because you gotta understand, I grew up in this school. So, you know, I had read extensively about these people. So it was incredible. But even looking back, it's even more profound. Like, wow, like what a blessing that was to be able to like hear John Henry Clark in person, you know what I'm saying, before he passed, and, you know, all these incredible, Francis Cress Welsing, all these brilliant minds. It was pretty amazing. And it was funny, like, because at the time I was like, yo, I want to go to a regular public school. I've been in private school all my life. I know everybody. I've been knowing everybody since I was like 3 years old. I'm tired. I want to go somewhere else, right? My parents was like, nope. Like, this is the only thing that they have. And they worked super hard. Like, my father worked hard, you know, to pay that tuition. And, you know, sometimes he didn't have it, but we had the relationship with the school. Right. They understood how important it was to, you know, make sure I was there and learning and still present. So, you know, it wasn't no easy thing to keep me there, but I realize now how important that was for me to continue to have an environment where I was loved and I was cared for, and my culture was paramount to anything else. My standards, my people's standards were paramount to any other standards. And when I saw my folks in our languages, it was beautiful. It didn't feel inferior like the world tried to tell us it was. It felt just brilliant. And being able to have access to that and being exposed to that at an early age was like such a key factor in my development, my intellect, you know, how I view the world. And I'm super grateful for that.
Right. That makes a ton of sense, man. And another thing that I know people might think about too, like just listening to your background and your experience, you're like the dream child for like a conscious parent. You went to the school, you know, you experienced the books, the learning, Dr. Welsing, Dr. John Henry Clark, Kwame Ture, everything. And, you know, you still had your own struggles. And in your song, Forever, you mentioned struggling with your self-esteem, your body image, and even doing some self-harming as a teenager. So how is it that you can experience that and still have these internal struggles, you know, with yourself?
Because I was torn. The wider world, it's again, I said that I was sheltered to an extent. I was privileged to an extent to have this environment, especially growing up where I grew up. You know, most of my friends from the block, peers, they had to go to public schools where they weren't cared for. They weren't taught, you know, anything real, you know, about who they were. They didn't have access to a lot of the things I had access to. So like, I was privileged to have this like other world, but at the same time, I was still very much aware of what was happening around me. And I wasn't immune to, my family wasn't immune to the damaging effects of the crack era. And we struggled, you know, we struggled with that. And it was hard for me to reconcile that, you know, my parents were human. You see you put your parents on a pedestal, you know, as people who are these shining examples, can do no wrong. But when you see cracks in that, or you see that they are in fact vulnerable to stresses and all the other things that make us who we are as humans, it's hard to reconcile that fact when you're young. Mm-hmm. So, and then also, you know, I was also part of the wider world when I'm watching media and people and models of what is beautiful, of what is perfection, you know, of what is valued and what is allowed to be given airtime and in platforms. And I didn't see a whole lot of me. And so while I loved who I was, I loved my people. I loved, you know, how beautiful we were and the wide range of that beauty. I still was grappling with these standards, you know, the wider world that is America. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, coupled with teenage, preteen angst and, you know, anger at my situation, you know, being affected by, you know, what was going on in the streets. It was a whole lot of that that I internalized, and it came out in these negative ways. But I will say the arts has always been a lifeline for me. And my parents were the first ones to instill that in me. Like when they were, we talked a little bit about me being in the hospital, you know, early. And one of the things that kept them afloat was music. So they were able to express to me, or I just saw an example. I saw real-time examples of how music, like Gil Scott Heron and Earth, Wind & Fire, and all these different artists were able to be a life raft for them. They were able to articulate their feelings in ways that they never could express on their own. And I developed that same relationship with music when I was going through my stuff, my struggles, when I felt like I couldn't speak, no one would understand me, the music would speak for me. And so when I started writing, I was like, that's what I'm gonna do. I'm gonna speak for the voiceless. I'm gonna speak for anybody else who was ever in my situation or anything like it, who felt powerless. I'm gonna be that source of power, first for me, and then for anybody else who it resonates with. Mm. So,
yeah, that is so powerful, man. And thank you for, you know, opening up and sharing that experience that you had. You know, a lot of times when we look at artists that kind of don't go in that deep, like we have this picture perfect person that we paint in our heads about who they are and what they've been through and things like that. And I think when it comes to people like role models, people that we look up to and things like that, they should be like real people, and we should see them like that and see our experience within them. So thank you for kind of giving that to us so we can, you know, really dissect some of those things. So your next mission was Howard, home of Dr. Welsing, even though they didn't give her tenure, but we ain't gonna talk about
Toni
that.
Toni Morrison.
The history is vast, but you said you didn't even want to go there in a previous interview.
I didn't want to go to Howard. It's because when you've been somewhere your whole life, and it's not like I had anything against Howard. I loved Howard. I would go on campus with my older sisters and be like, oh my God, this is so dope. But DC is a small city, you know, It can be very small, especially when you start running into people that you see all the time. Like, damn, I can't be unseen here. You know what I'm saying? When I want to be. So it was more about like wanting to get out of the city than anything against Howard. But I was 16 at the time, and my parents were like, you're not leaving. You're not leaving DC on your own to go anywhere, because I wanted to go somewhere in New York or California. I just wanted to get as far away as I could. And again, it's one of those things where parents know best. And I ended up loving my experience. Howard is one of those places where fine arts is like the center and the nucleus of campus. So like on the yard, like when you leave class after going to your Pan-Africanism class or your class on hieroglyphics and all these dope little classes that really spoke to who we were as Black students, you go on the yard and the fine arts students would just be like belting out songs or like doing choreography on the front steps of like fine arts. And I'd be like, oh my God, I wish I could be a fine arts. Like, I was just like, you know, just so enamored with like the freedom that they had and like just the pure joy they had in expressing their creativity. My parents were like, no, you're going to do something practical. So I was a bio major, and I ended up minoring in fine arts. But I was a bio major down in the valley. You know, I felt like a little gremlin. We rarely saw the light of day. Science and biology was my first love. And I think that anybody who knows that can go back and listen to my music and be like, oh,
yeah,
okay.
I was just going to say that. Yep.
Yeah. I use a lot of like references. And then also I'm super into like sci-fi and stuff like that. So you'll hear a lot of that, metaphysics, spirituality. So like all of that is just kind of like imbued in my music. But yeah.
Yeah. Did you ever get to go to a Dr. Welsing lecture while you were over there?
No. Okay. But we had this thing called the anniversary dinner at my school. And they would invite guest speakers, esteemed elders in the community, guest speakers, and we would celebrate the anniversary of the school's founding. It was amazing. But anyway, she spoke there. So I guess technically I have heard, you know, a baby version of one of her lectures. But yeah.
That is awesome, man. I'm jealous. When I was in college, I was actually supposed to make a trip to one of her lectures. And I was like, I'll just go another time. Like, you know what I mean? But not knowing, you know,
that they would be. I know, it's like those things, like you don't know in the moment that like this is like something that you need to do. This person might not be around forever, or, you know, just any number of things. You might not get this opportunity again. I feel the same way about like so many other, you know, people that I just didn't, dang, I had this opportunity to go meditate with Raoul Nefermin, the author of Medina Terra, and I didn't do it. And now,
wow,
I don't know where he is.
man, so. But you've done so many other great things, man. Another thing, like with your experience at Howard, I was listening to your song with Brother Ali, We Got This, and you mentioned, you know, you gave up your BA for another set of letters and transitioned into the ATL. So what did that decision involve, and what was that experience like, you know, just moving on from your BA and then going into a whole nother culture, state, and the ATL and everything? What kind of went into that decision for you?
Well, what went into that decision was that I wanted to leave DC. And originally I was supposed to move to New York, but then I saw them prices and I was like, we're gonna have to rethink that. And my sisters had already moved down to Atlanta, and so I was like, okay, maybe Atlanta, I have like people down there. My brother was getting ready to move down there at the time. So I was like, okay, I could do Atlanta. You know, it seems cheaper. I'd been there before. My homegirl was in school down there. So I was like, okay, let me do Atlanta and see what's up. And I had no plan. I just was figuring it out, you know? And of course I gravitated towards the cultural community. And in Atlanta, as many other cities, sometimes like the cultural community and like the hip hop community will intersect. Well, in Atlanta, at least it did. And so like I would be going to fundraisers and stuff for political prisoners. I would be going to lectures and stuff. And there will be, you know, these independent hip hop artists there who were super dope performing. And so that would happen like all the time. Like they would tap the activists and elders in the community would tap like these artists who are making this dope music to perform at these events and stuff. And so all that stuff would be like a crossover. But before that, I ended up, you know, meeting Soul Messiah, who's a DJ producer from Atlanta. He has worked with like so many dope artists. He had just finished working with this dope group at the time called Jadis. And I heard their stuff and I was like, oh man, they're so dope. And I was just obsessed with like listening to their album. Like I was memorizing all the lyrics. I kept listening to their album. And then he would make like beat CDs at the time. So I would just like take his CDs and just be listening like they were, you know, not instrumentals, like they were full songs. Mm-hmm. And I was obsessed. And so I've said this over and over again, but let me see if I can spice it up.
I mean, this is your superhero story right here, man. This is like getting the powers right here. So
I feel like in listening to their music, I was like, you know how when you see somebody like, I don't know, like back in the day we did Double Dutch, or you see somebody dancing or whatever, you'd be like, I could do that. You know. The whole time I'm like, you know, kind of unconsciously or subconsciously like amping myself up. And like I said, I wrote poetry and stuff. Never did spoken word or anything. I just did like regular, like written poetry.
Just for you.
And just for me. Mm-hmm. And you know, for classes and stuff like that. But one day I was in the studio with Soul Messiah and he's playing beats and stuff. And, you know, I was like, let me see what I can do. You know, let me take, I took one of my poems and I got in the booth and rapped over one of his beats. Cause I just wanted to hear my voice. Like that's the ego.
Yeah. You know, yeah.
Emerging. You want to hear how you sound recording. Right. Uh-huh. And so he heard it and I was like, that's actually not bad. He's like, okay. Cause he tells me later, like one of the key things that he looks for like MCs or potential MCs to work with is that rhythm, like being able to ride the beat. And I was able to do that with no like background in MCing or whatever. And he was shocked. He was surprised. And he's worked with female women MCs before. And he was hungry to do that again. So he was like, all right, can you do that again? So we instantly started. He's like that. Like he's like, once he latches on to an idea, he's going to like, I'm not going to stop until I make it happen. So he loaded me up with beats, and we ended up creating my first EP called Astral Chronicles. And one of the first songs on there that I released was the song called First Mother. We called it Asasiya, which is essentially translates to Mother Earth, but Asasiya is a deity in the Akan tradition of West Africa who is celebrated for her role in sustaining life. And so that was one of the first songs I did that's similar to Sky God. It's kind of like a mantra for Black women to really tap into that power, to really tap into how ancient we are, you know, how vast we are, you know, how, you know, this entire world just kind of like orbits around us, essentially. So that was one of the first songs I did. And I talked about how like the activist cultural community and the hip hop community intersect. The first performance I ever did was completely unplanned and unbeknownst to me. I was at a fundraiser for Mutu Shakur, and the homie Iros Levi, he has a he did a radio show with Soul Messiah, and it was called Beats and Lyrics. He works a lot with like the incarcerated brothers and stuff. But he was like, yo, is Cy-Rock in the building? Cy-Rock, come up here. I'm just like, oh my God. Mind you, I have not ever, so I've done theater and stuff, so that's fine. Because you're reciting lines, like you're playing a character. But I've never spit before on stage. So I'm like, but I knew Hip Hop 101, you can't turn down somebody's like, you know, invitation on the stage or you're not a real MC.
Yeah.
All right, let me go up here. You know, I'm all like hunched over and like awkward, and like I instantly go into like beast mode when I'm performing, like just super growly and growling and you know, that fierce energy. And they loved it. Like the people loved it. And I was like, that was the first moment where I was like, I might be able to do this thing here.
I think I've seen that video too. On
really?
YouTube. I think I have seen that. That was probably one of my first introductions to you. I was like, yo, who is this? And from there, I just kind of started looking into all your work because you were on the grind, man. Like your first few years coming in, like just putting stuff out. And I was just like, yo, she got a lot of stuff out. Like, you know, so just checking your stuff
out. We were really just grinding because I was working full-time. At one point I went back to school full-time. I had two jobs. I had a part-time job, full-time job, and I was going to school.
Ooh.
And then I was doing music too. And it was almost like I never like envisioned what it was going to turn into. Mm-hmm. I'm not a dreamer. Mm. And I had to come to terms with that. Like I'm very much like in the moment, like what I'm doing right now. So, you know, if I vibe with it, if I enjoy it, I'll keep doing it. And if it like helps me in some kind of way, I'll just keep doing it without any like idea or plans for what it's going to turn into. So I'm just doing it. Unbeknownst to me, Soul Messiah had plenty of plans. So I'm just, you know, writing, and he's very prolific in the way that he creates. So I was keeping up with him. And there was a lot of like competition at the time. There were a lot of like dope MCs who were coming out. So like he would throw like a beat, then be like, okay, yo, spit something over this, write something and spit something over this. This is how we like stay relevant or whatever. And we're always mm-hmm. shooting like videos and stuff. We had the worst camera. We had the worst. I mean, it was decent for that time, but like he didn't have like cinematography skills. I certainly didn't have like any kind of charisma in front of the camera. I was like barely looking at the camera in the beginning. Like
I think that's how you see growth though. Like that those moments I think is when you see the most growth, like looking into, you know, the cinematography of your work now, like with music like Forever and all your other, you know, music videos from the past, you know, going back into the past. I was actually doing that before prepping for the interview, just looking at your early stuff into now. And it's like watching, you know, a family member grow and develop, and you know what I'm saying? Like it there's a beautiful element to that. You know?
Yeah, I mean, I like that I can really kind of chart my goals, because I really was like growing. I was learning how to be an MC. I was learning the culture as I was doing it in real time, mm-hmm. you know? So it was dope to be able to essentially be thrown into the fire like that, because it made me catch up really quickly, I feel like, because I'm a competitive person by nature. And so like, we were putting out all this product, putting out all this work. And it's funny, like there are people at the time who were like, you're doing too much, you know, you're putting out, so you don't want to saturate the market. But we were just writing just as fast as we could create. And it ended up working out to our benefit, because mm-hmm. because we had so much content, that increased our visibility. And so we were one of the earlier kind of duos to perform outside of Atlanta, to eventually perform internationally, because right. I had that awareness because of all this work that I put out. We were doing like one, sometimes two albums a year, two releases a year.
Oof. Man, so just thinking about, number one, the amount of work that you were putting in, and then if people dissect and break down your lyrics, like you could have a college study class about your lyrics and everything you're talking about, right? How do you kind of, first off, what is your writing process like to really write like that? And then second off, how do you remember that when you're performing on stage and you have to kind of get that and get everything on point? Like, you're using high level words and all type of things. Like, what is your process for remembering and writing and everything?
Well, I remember most of my lyrics through like the writing process itself. So like, I'll write 4, 6, 8 bars and I'll keep going over it, because I have to, you know, spit it and record it or whatever. So I'll keep going over it. So like, I'll have the majority of it already just kind of ingrained in my memory, just because the way that I write, I'm constantly like reciting what I write and playing it back to myself. But it really just depends. It depends on my inspiration at the moment. I try to create a vibe for myself. I burn my little copal incense to get me in that proper headspace and kind of a meditative state to channel what I need to channel. And I love to be alone. I don't record in like any public studios, open studios. I don't often record with other people. And it's usually at odd times of the day. You know, it's just whenever I feel, you know, that inspiration or really just the necessity of writing. It depends. Like, sometimes I'm inspired strictly from the beat. Like, if the beat is super jamming or it evokes some kind of emotion or something like that, that gets the pen going, that'll be all it takes. There might be sometimes if I'm inspired by a particular topic or issue. Sometimes it's been people online talking ish, you know, people like that. It's creeps online, trolls online that have inspired some of my doper songs. just that sheer anger, like, oh yeah, okay, let me write a song about you.
I definitely felt that competitive edge with Kendrick's Control verse. That I think you had the best verse on that. Like, you know, when everybody went crazy over his Control verse and everybody wanted to spit to that. And when I heard yours, I was like, yo, this is the one right here, man. Like,
I had fun doing that. See, that's the thing. Like, that was when we had actual inspiration. Like, we had people who were dope in my mind, who were worthy competitors. So there was all of this kind of friendly and not so friendly competition. And I say not so friendly because, you know, as an MC, you gotta get your, you know, your swords popping.
No,
know,
friends.
Your friends afterwards. Yeah, you know, exactly. Possibly. I don't know Kendrick, but I'm saying, like, if it is your homeboy, your homegirl or whatever, y'all can be cool and chop it up and eat good afterwards, but you killing them on the track, you know?
Yep.
So I miss those days because there was so much competitive inspiration out there. Like, somebody would do something and I'd be like, okay, I'm gonna do you one better. And I would instantly just write something and throw it out. But I feel like now it's a little more challenging to do that because a lot of people have dumbed down flows to kind of fit with this mainstream style of, I don't know, simplistic.
Yeah, like it's really about the beat and the hook and everything. Like, people don't really pay attention as much to like lyrics like that anymore. And it's really sad. Like,
value lyricism.
Yeah. You know? for me, much. Like, it's kind of depressing as a New Yorker, because we grew up on Jay-Z, Nas, and right. you know, all these folks where you were playing the lyrics back and you're like, yo, I didn't even know he said that. Or right. you know, certain right. references, you're like, yo, that's crazy. Like, you know what I'm saying? We don't get that from music like that no more, man. And I think that is the importance of people like you and, you know, keeping that element of hip hop alive, because it's kind of transgressed into this new era of, you know, showmanship and, you know, I'm going to show you off kind of thing and rhyme
about. Yeah, and half the time it's not even proper showmanship. Half these shows, people rapping over their tracks or not rapping at all, like giving the mic to the crowd to have them rap their lyrics. And it's just like so strange. It's like we're living in bizarro world. And yeah. I can appreciate someone who has the charisma and energy to be able to rock the crowd. But that missing piece is that elevated skill. Like, you gotta have both. And that's important, you know? So we holding it down for real lyricism out here.
Yes, yes. And like I said, it'll be in the college classes. So yeah, your stuff is the stuff that's gonna live on, man. Going forward into like your career, like you spent a good amount of time as an independent artist, and then you got an opportunity with Rhymesayers. And with them, you went on to do a joint venture. So for those that kind of just don't have an idea what that is, I know a lot of people talk about just being an independent artist, the difficulty, but the reward aspect of it. So what made the having a joint venture with Rhymesayers really stand out to you? And what exactly is it, first off, and what made it stand out to you for you to pursue that that deal with them?
It means that you still have your independent publishing company, and they don't have full ownership over your masters and or your publishing royalties, none of that. So there is, of course, an incentive in signing with the company, and they do take a percentage of your typical things like your merch and your sales, but it's reasonable. And you're able to use them as a platform to amplify your voice, to use their reach, to use their built-in audience base, to use their resources, to use all of these things that could benefit you greatly, you know, being, you know, two people just doing it out of their home, you know what I'm saying? Struggling to make it happen and doing it all by ourselves. So then now you have teams that are handling your booking for you, teams that are helping you like execute your creative vision, but putting you on a timeline and making sure that it's reaching more people, and then putting financial resources behind things that might be too much of a burden for you to bear alone. Because we were literally doing everything, hand pressing merch ourselves.
Wow.
You know what I mean? Sometimes driving the shows before, you know, we got to the point where people were flying us out and stuff. But like, it's stressful having to do all of the business side as well as the creative stuff. And that's not my strong point. Soul Messiah, like that's his, he can do that. But still, you know, he's a creative as well. And it helps him to be able to just focus on the music and focus on, you know, but the beauty of it is your creative vision is paramount. Like there's no one dictating what you should be doing. There's no one dictating like what your content should look like, what your imagery should look like. You are the sole person responsible for that. But they, you know, of course, can give you their outside opinion or like established opinion of what works best and things like that. But it's just dope to have this other arm to do your heavy lifting, if right. you will. So
that makes sense. I'm glad that opportunity came about for you. Man, I can't imagine making merch yourself, like, and doing all that. Woof, man. Mm-hmm. I've dabbled in doing some merch on my own. And like the first time I did, I was like, yeah, I don't want to do this.
Yeah. I have to credit Soul Messiah. I have to credit him. Cause before, you know, we went to like printing companies and stuff, he was hand pressing that stuff. And, you know, we would come up with the ideas and he would get it popping. And, you know, I still hold on to some of the early shirts that we have just to kind of remind myself of how far we've come You know, like, look, this is the first Africa tee that we pressed. My homegirl, Renee Nayland, I gave her the design for that. And she, you know, did the graphic design and we pressed the first thing up. And yeah, it's we've come a long way.
Yeah, that is dope, man. And speaking of coming a long way, one of your latest albums with Rhymesayers that you came out with was Sharecropper's Daughter, which was an excellent album. It did take some time to come out. You know, you worked with a lot of greats like Black Thought, Styles P, Saul Williams, which I love.
Chronix. Betty.
Yeah, like, so what was it like putting that album together and, you know, Sharecropper's Daughter? What, I know it has some deep significance to you, so can you touch on that a little bit?
Yeah, it was really a story of my journey. And I wanted to highlight, I call it the Sharecropper's Daughter because my father grew up on a farm sharecropping. His parents, like, that was their livelihood, if you want to call it that. And as a young person, I found myself at odds with my father a lot because I felt he didn't understand me. And, you know, we were so different. We had, like, you know, we thought about things so differently. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't until I got older that I realized that many of our experiences that I thought were so different were actually very similar, just a reworking of, you know, these experiences. When I think about him growing up in the Jim Crow era and having to face overt racism and poverty and systems stacked against him. And I compare that to growing up in the crack era, where systems were still stacked against us, that we were experiencing racism, but it was more covert. It was more insidious. It was more established, right, you know, if you will, within institutions. And I was like, yo, we're still dealing with the same thing. And I started writing on the album shortly after, I think, Mike Brown. It was either Mike Brown or Trayvon Martin. And I hate that there are two instances that are so similar that kind of like sparked me to write. But I just couldn't wrap my head around the fact that, you know, we're still dealing with this when, you know, Emmett Till happened not far from where my father was a child. You know what I'm saying? What happened to Emmett Till? So I was like, yo, we're still dealing with children dying, being murdered at the hands of this wicked construct that exists here in this country. That kind of like made me realize how closely linked we were, even though the design was a little different, you know? So I wanted to just really honor him and all of the things that he kind of imbued in me, and this honor the idea that although, you know, both of us had faced so much trauma, my father was very, very insistent about like telling us about like all of these things that had happened to him. And sometimes it was very heavy, like too much for me to bear as a child. But knowing that, you know, we had this history and understanding what my family had endured through and we had thrived, like look what my father being able to be, you know, this artist and being able to raise children and work his fingers to the bone to put us in private school because he was so intentional about us having more and doing more and understanding how rich and storied our people's history was and how it was more than just slavery. It was more than just hardship. There was also all of this dopeness, you know? And so that's one of the things that I want to express. I wanted to express that despite the fact that I have this heavy, heavy history, like I also have, you know, memories of hand dancing in the living room with my parents and you know, having fun and listening to music and rifling through albums. And, you know, I got the creative gene from my dad and, you know, all of these things. Like there is triumph in the midst of trauma. There is value. There is beauty. There is, we are worthy despite our circumstances, despite the things that we think or society would like us to believe mars us or stigmatizes us in some way. So right. That was the purpose of that album, to celebrate all of the beauty, you know, that my family had instilled in my genetic bloodline. So that was the point of that. But in writing the album, it took so long because it was like super emotional. And it was, I had to decide what to keep, how much to divulge. You know, my father had done these interludes for, I couldn't even listen to those interludes without like crying. He cried like during some of the, you know, recounting of these stories. And so I was like, no, I'm not going to use interludes because that's too private. That's too personal. I'm going to keep that for myself. So there was all of this, you know, all of these things to consider, because it's this thing of an artist, like, how much do you reveal? I want to share. I want to be transparent, but I also want to have something of my own.
Right. And just have that respect for your family, too. Like, you know.
Yeah, exactly. Like, not all the stories are mine to tell. You know, some of them, you know, if they affect me directly, I feel like I'm free to share. But like, not all of them are mine to tell. And then it was like, things were just happening. Like, as we were writing, like, we would have a connect. Like, we ended up, I'm a part of this organization called Hip Hop is Green. I'm like an ambassador with them. And Styles P also has worked with them. And then, you know, I was not planning on, you know, having Styles P feature. But when I saw him at this event that we did, Hip Hop is Green is like an organization that teaches about environmental sustainability, the importance of environmental sustainability and plant-based eating on the environment. He uses hip hop as a vehicle to spread that message because it's so influential. But anyway, we're on this panel and I'm like, yo, okay. How about we get Styles on the joint? How about we get Ghosts on there? And that ended up happening, you know, just off like the humble connect. And like all these things just kind of like happened. Like I ended up connecting with Lettucey because I did a song with this drummer named Little John who drums for Janet Jackson. And I did a song with him and she's friends with him. She heard the song, was like, yo, it was so amazing. I was like, okay, let me shoot my shot here. How about you sing on this song with me? So that happened. So it's just like all these little things that kind of fell into place. And I think that the timing was perfect, even though it was a little longer than I had expected. It was perfect for, you know, getting all of these pieces to make the album as great as it was.
Yeah, that is so dope, man. So you kind of go from the height of your career pretty much into the pandemic. So what, like, did you have an expectation of what that would be like? What was that experience like for you? And then I know, like, a beautiful experience that came out of the pandemic for you was being able to be a part of the Tiny Desk, you know, series and doing that performance, which was an amazing performance, by the way. So what was that experience like for you, and how did you maneuver through all of that as an artist that was out and about all the time, you know, performing live and doing everything?
It was crazy. It was right off the end of the Rhapsody tour. I was direct support for Rhapsody for her. A Black woman created this tour. Mm. And we ended up having to cancel the last show. And we were so hurt because it was in Raleigh. And that's like it's not her hometown, but that's like her, you know, second home, if you will. And so it's still, even with that, like it still didn't fully hit me. I was like, damn, I had to cancel the last show. But, you know, there's still Europe, because I had a European tour like a week after. I was supposed to go home, get home from the tour, from the Rhapsody tour, and then go leave out for Europe the week after. And then when that got canceled and, you know, we realized the severity of what this was and how it was impacting everything, shocking, to say the least. Disruptive for me as it was for everybody else. It was scary because we didn't know what was happening. But for me as a performer, like one of the things that is most liberating about performing, about being an MC, is the ability to perform. That's where I can free up and, you know, having that connection with my supporters and being able to deliver my songs using my full body, my full voice, you know, freely on stage is one of the joys of why I do this. I quickly realized how like important, like how integral that was, because to my, I don't want to say worth, but kind of, because when I didn't have it, I was just stumped. I felt a little depressed I didn't know what to do with myself. I hadn't released the album yet. I was going to be releasing it later on in the fall, but not being able to kind of have that connection and being removed from people as an introvert, it sounds odd to say that now not being able to interact with people that I felt, I don't know, like it was such a huge challenge for me.
I think it was extreme though. It's like, as an introvert, I'm an introvert as well. You know, every now and then we interact, like, but the extremism of just like, all right, you got to stay in your house for that, you know, extended period of time. And if you come into contact with anybody, then there's a risk you might get the virus and all this kind of stuff. So you couldn't even do the little family stuff like that introverts like to do. Like, you know what I mean? Like that little stuff.
Right. Our people, we cool. Like we good. So it required a lot of self-reflection for me because I was like, this is interesting that this has become so much a part of you that you don't know how to function without it.
Yeah.
That it almost brought me to like a standstill, and everybody was kind of figuring it out. Like, how do we, cause I'm not a super huge fan of like having to consistently do the social media thing. Like I do it and it's fine. But like to be able like to super be on it and like be present online and stuff like that, I'm not a fan of that. And so seeing everybody pivot to that, I was like, damn, I gotta do this now. I don't really like doing this. So it required a lot of like reflection and meditation and like to for me to be cool with adapting. And I think that was the biggest thing. Like it's hard for me to adapt and pivot. Like I like things a certain way. So it ended up working out. Like, you know, I ended up becoming at peace with what the situation was and trying to figure out new ways to kind of connect. I was doing some online shows. And like you said, I ended up doing the Tiny Desk, which was really dope because I think the level of that one, the exposure was incredible. And, you know, I've watched a ton of Tiny Desk performances. So to be able to join some of, you know, the most esteemed performers out there was just an incredible experience. But like, that was the closest thing to feeling like I was doing a real performance.
Right.
So it was really, really dope for me. And then that exposure was really dope.
So I kind of want to get into this because I think, you know, you are esteemed enough to be able to answer this question. As a Black female artist, especially hip hop artist, we talked about kind of the changes that's occurred in hip hop. And part of that change, you know, is a different image as it relates to Black females and Black women. And you've kind of done the opposite. You've maintained that image of what it's supposed to be like. So what do you say to the other MCs that are, you know, transitioning into that new image of, I guess, you know, hypersexualized? And some of them might just say like, yo, I'm just chasing the bag. This is what sells right now. Not aware, or maybe they are aware that there's a little Black girl staring at the screen and wanting to be that and has embodied that image as well. So do you think that the artists now, like, do we have like a responsibility to that little Black girl to be able to send her a message of what it means to be a Black woman in the right way? Or is that, you know, just too much? Like, this is just an artist that's trying to hustle, make some money and do what they got to do. They shouldn't have all that extra stuff, you know, in the mix of it as well. So what is your take on that?
No, I think that there is definitely responsibility. It's to an extent, because I think that creativity shouldn't be confined. But I do think that there is a responsibility with being as authentic and as intentional and as righteous with your, I mean, let me not say righteous, because honestly, there's a lot of music that, I've listened to that have formed like the foundation of hip hop that's absolutely not righteous, but we listen to it anyway, right?
Yeah.
But I think for me, the issue is balance. I think that we need to consider that our art form is more than just an art form. It's a culture. And we are essentially creating a time capsule of how we are to be remembered 50, 100, you know, years from now. And as a Black woman who I'm speaking from my perspective, but I'm also speaking on behalf of women like me who may not have the opportunity to express themselves or see themselves on a larger platform. So I do have a sense of responsibility about like what I'm saying, my words. And when we think about like what DMC is in its relation to, we talk about like the facets, and we connect like the facets of hip hop to like African traditions. So like the MC is essentially the griot, or, you know, the Jali, if you want to call it, get the traditional name for it or whatever, who are really essentially the oral historians who are speaking to the times, or speaking about the times and what is happening, what's going on. You know, there's a little bit of the MC thing, like the bombast. We put on a show, you know, right, essentially. But I think what some of these women are seeing as empowerment, they're not like really examining fully who's pulling the strings in this industry and who holds the true power and whose influences hold sway over their choices to present themselves a certain way, to rhyme about a certain thing, you know. And I feel like we're not being honest about why we're doing what we're doing. Like you mentioned, like people saying like, oh, I'm just trying to get the bag, you know what I'm saying? And we create these ideas about why we're doing a certain thing, like these motivations for why we're doing a certain thing, when essentially we're creating justifications and excuses for just trying to get money. And I understand where that motivation comes from. If you're coming from a background where you didn't have much and you get into this place where, you know, you finally get to make all this money, you just have to work this formula. I understand where it comes from, but I don't overstand it, because my heroes were people like Nina Simone's and people like Lauryn Hill's and people like Toni Morrison's, who were very, very focused on the legacy that the culture would leave behind. And if someone were to look back at some of these mainstream women MCs, I can't speak to what's empowering to somebody else. We're all different. We're not a monolith. Mm-hmm. But if what is being pushed is this vapid, one-dimensional depiction of what womanhood is and what femininity is and all these things, if that's what's being pushed on a larger scale, then that will be representing all of us, even though we're not all checking for that. We don't all express ourselves that way. We don't all dress that way. You know, there's bigger things that we need to be examining, exploring, speaking about. And it's really our responsibility to our listeners to be, you know, true about this thing, to be, to set examples, whether we like it or not. Whether we like it or not, we are setting examples for everybody who's looking towards us. And a lot of times that is going to be young men, young girls, young women. And we inevitably become sometimes what they aspire to be. So like, look at it like what you want your child to be. If this, you know, that's how I look at it. And again, like the artist's responsibility can't be solely that, because you have to be free to be an artist as well. But that has to be like a key part of your kind of creative motivation, I feel like.
Yeah, that makes a ton of sense. And I completely understand. I actually remember in a classroom, I had a young lady who was presenting a project, and she mentioned she wanted to be like one of these mainstream artists, female artists. So I asked her, like, I'm like, do you think she's a good role model? And she said no. And I was like, so like what makes you want to be like them? And she was kind of stuck. So I just left it alone. But, you know, we you know, that makes a lot of sense, because these girls are chasing that imagery and they don't even understand why, just because it's out there. But yeah, thank you for kind of really explaining that. I do think we do have this responsibility that some of us might just not be aware of, because not, you know, a lot of people didn't grow up in that African centered and that importance of giving back to the black community and your image and all that kind of stuff. So doesn't make it, you know, excusable though. So thank you for responding to that. So just looking into like legacy, man, like years and years and years from now, when they are giving a lecture about Ciroc or reading from one of your songs or breaking it down in a college setting, a college class and everything? What is the legacy that you want to leave behind, and what do you want people to remember about the essence of who you are, who you were, and what you embodied while you were here?
Liberation, liberation, liberation. Like, that's literally what I'm here to do, is to promote not only self-liberation, but liberation for our community, liberation for the spirit beyond this the constraints of this physical body, liberation for the mind beyond the oppressive constraints of the miseducation of this world, you know, school systems, and then just general cultural zeitgeist that teaches us to be robots and zombies and, you know, not want for freedom, but to be these automatons or whatever. But the thing for me is, if I can provide an example for people to be able to be comfortable with looking within themselves for sources of power and not outward, and understanding just how powerful we are and the connectivity we have to the vastness and brilliance and all of the knowledge of the universe. Like, we are tapped into that. We are part of that. And understanding that, overstanding that, is one of the key things that lets people understand what vehicles for change they can be in this world. Specifically for African people in the diaspora, it's important for me to air out, to encourage people to air it out, because we've held on for so much. We've been, you know, these incredible pillars of strength and resiliency for so long. We just stuff a lot of stuff down that manifests into physical health issues and, you know, anxieties and all of these things. And thinking about creativity and art as a vehicle for healing, it's incredibly important for me. You know, I think of it like it's like non-religious missionary work, teaching people how to sift through those traumas and find the power, find the light, and be comfortable with that. Be comfortable with shining that light. Be comfortable with blinding people, if that's what it takes, with that light, instead of shrinking, instead of muting ourselves. That's just like paramount to me when I think about like what my music leaves behind. And it's paramount for me to channel my own parts of me that I've suppressed or been quiet about or held on to like let it be known, let it be shown, so people can possibly see a reflection of themselves within me and start to reflect that to others. And that's super, super duper important for me. Liberation, freedom, liberation, freedom, all day, every day.
Man, thank you for that, man. Well said. I am so honored and blessed for the interview. It's exactly how amazing I thought it was going to be when I pictured it in my head, when I'm like, yo, got to get Ciroc on, like, yo. So I'm hyped, man. Thank you so much for coming through and just blessing, you know, Mastermind with your presence and your wonderful words of wisdom and your journey and everything. I appreciate it. If you could do us one last favor, we always ask our guests to leave us with their favorite quote and what it means to them, or even your favorite affirmation, or whatever it is that you want to use and what it means to you.
Dang. It's a quote by Octavia Butler. And it starts off, first, forget inspiration. She talks about, you know, inspiration essentially being a myth. You know, we can't depend on it as creatives, and that what truly is going to refine your pen or refine your skill set and whatever you do is going to come from habit and persistence. And it starts off, first, forget inspiration. Habit is more dependable. Something like habit will sustain you whether you're inspired or not. Habit will help you finish and fine tune your stories. And then it says inspiration won't do that. Like, habit is persistence and practice. I believe that's what the quote is.
I got you. It's habit will sustain you whether you're inspired or not. Habit will help you finish and polish your stories. Inspiration won't. habit is persistence in practice.
Yes. Yes. That so I'm always paraphrasing that quote, because I don't, you know, I don't want to perpetuate this idea that, oh, we're just all like, having these aha euphoric moments of like creative inspiration. It takes a lot of hard work. It takes a lot of just kind of refining your craft and your skill and rewriting and writing and rewriting and throwing stuff away and having millions of edits. And some days, some months, some weeks, you may not be inspired to pick up a pen, but then other times, you know, the words are flowing. But it's definitely work. It's a beautiful work, but it's definitely work.
Absolutely, man. Thank you so much for that, man. I feel like I'm definitely going to review this interview, like just so many gems, a lot to think about. Octavia Butler, another great. Yeah, so thank you for coming on. Listeners, please share the program. You could find Cyrock on all streaming platforms. You can find her through Instagram. Cyrock, right? On your Instagram?
Is
your
Cyrock the MC on Instagram. Sarocthemc on Instagram. Yep. And Twitter.
And as far as your music, everything is through all the streaming platforms.
You can get music directly from my website too. It's www.sarocc.com. That's sarocc.com.
Beautiful, beautiful. Like, and people can find your merch on that as well, right?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Excellent, yeah. excellent. Please support Cyrock. She's doing amazing things for the culture, for our culture, and we need to support people like her. And just her having her as a representation instead of what the mainstream promotes in us. There's better in us, and there is Cyrock. So definitely support her music. If you haven't listened yet, you are in for a treat. Definitely stick around after the program. We'll play a few of her songs, her amazing songs. So share the program, check out Cyrock, and share her music as well. Thank you for listening. And of course, remember, your mind is the most powerful tool in the universe. Therefore, if you can think it, you can do it. If you believe in it, you can be it. And if you fight for it, you can have it. The world is yours. This has been your host, Mr. G, and I'll see you next time on Mastermind.
This is Cyrock, and you're listening to my single Forever off the Sharecropper's Daughter.
When I wake up, no makeup, half naked, I feel like I'm the shit. Pardon my language, but hang-ups do not define the kid. No, I'm not flawless, I'm scarred up and I'm fine with it. My body are the laundry list of all of life's unkindnesses. But I still sip tea and chant om and live free. Cause hardships and heartbreaks turn to rap epiphanies. And mom told me stay woke cause all gold ain't glistening. Choose your words wisely cause the all-knowing's listening. But no worries, I'm Gucci, my thighs are low juicy. My dialogue, low awkward, my idols still move me. My life is a movie like Raheem and Mookie. I'm just trying do the right thing, hope that it improves me. My bamboos accustomed to me, you'll be soon accustomed to me. This tomorrow I got royal hemoglobin coursing through me. And my strength is now inhuman, I get that straight from my homie. Signed in silver, mouth the grill of yours and truly.
You better shine on them, baby, you a star. You better be exactly who you are forever. Cause they gon' try and change your heart, don't let up. Cause you're so damn fine, just the way you better are. Shine on them, baby, you a star. You better
overnight. I was in that mirror like 4 or 5 times a week on my mile of beats, reciting affirmations like holy writings. And I still don't know everything, but I guess confessions from 8x11s and studio sessions seem like it's only right. And trust me, this my therapy. Fuck your couch. Finna murk all these Murphy types, funny styling me. Shut your mouth. Touch me, I'm slaughtering crew, squads, goons, teams. The queen is coming to rule your region, coming for all of your asses, plus your house. I ain't always have it in me. No tolerance for pretending. I was 14 years old, forcing pills down my throat, so my baby fat diminished. Still got these scars from cutting my wrist when I thought the life was finished. Now they remind me what my lows look like. Now I know the sky's the limit. Okay, never claim to be perfect. That's an impossible dream. I'm just saying that I'm worth it. That's the responsible thing. Spend half my life trying to find my life from outside sources. Why the only voice that mattered came from me?
You better shine on them, baby, you a star. You better be exactly who you are forever. Cause they gon' try and change your heart. Don't let up. Cause you're so damn fine just the way you better are. Shine on
aggressive, that's too masculine. And her content a little too obsessive, just relax a bit. She say she God, that's narcissistic, just the facts of it. Nah, I don't really F with female rappers, that's just sacrilege. Glad I learned early not to internalize every ink up. Daddy told me with every opinion there comes a sphincter. And they would rather she them thoughts than popularize a thinker. Why them lying archetypes is chasing cat, I'm trying to sphinx her. Rap barrel, skin caramello, apparel mainly vintage. Merrill composer, warrior, so every verse became a vengeance. Went through too much hair to not be fine, but they still feigning ignorance. So now I came to click my just do with remaining interest. Baby, I'm a star without the flash frame of Fenty. Came out the dock, lit up the entire game upon my entry. Kept it 100, messed around and gained another century. In this now I'm aiming to pop off till my mental chamber's empty. I'm unbothered, your standards is irrelevant. I might F around and rock a body, all this for the hell of it. They've been trying to martyr me for ages cause my melanin. So now I'm soaking UV rays with sugar slathered on my adamant. My dude, I'm magic, my game is God is my mood. It's savage, that's gang, it's Connie's boss move. And mountains, my range, astonishing danger. Sonnets like rain and comets, they blazing. Trails through planets, all hell, it's kind of amazing. That's right, we'll call it self-love. Discovered I was dope and indulge like I'm scale drugs. And you could call me arrogant and that's gonna help love. But if you trying to knock me down, your demolitions fail, bruh, fail, bruh, fail, bruh, fail.
You better shine on them, baby, you a star. You better be exactly who you are forever. Cause they gon' try and change your heart. Don't let up, cause you're so damn fine just the way you better are. Shine on them, baby, you a star. You better be exactly who you are forever. Cause they gon' try and change your heart. Don't let up, cause you're so damn fine just the way you better are. Shine on them, baby, you a star. You better be exactly who you are forever. Fine, just the way you better are. Shine on them, baby, you a star. You better be exactly who you are forever. Cause they gon' try and change your heart. Don't let up, cause you're so damn fine just the way you are.